Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.
You are now staring into the Twisted Mirror.
Have you ever had a moment when you looked at someone in the eye? Someone you thought you knew and wondered if you ever really knew them at all? It could be a secret they've kept, a betrayal, a story they never told about themselves that put them in an entirely new light. It can be especially shattering if this person was important to you. Makes you wonder if you loved an illusion, if everything about your relationship was a lie. But maybe what's more devastating than even that is it makes you wonder if you ever really even knew yourself. The night I met John was the worst night of my life. It was the best night of my life. I was 23 and in a bad way. I can't point to where I got lost, but by then it had been years of aimlessness. Drugs, drinking, and partying for days until I lost track of what month it was. My family was close-knit, but I was the black sheep, of course. They were devout fundamentalists, and I was anything but. I ran away at 16, and besides the occasional call from a phone booth in whatever city I happened to be in at the time, I hadn't really spoken to or seen them since. As harsh as it might sound, I didn't miss them, and I believed the feeling was mutual. I was an unrepentant sinner, prodigal daughter. They would welcome me back, of course, but only under the very suffocating conditions of their lifestyle. I'd have rather died with a needle in my arm than live that way. The night I met John, I had a heated argument about limited resources with my on and off again boyfriend. I can't remember what exactly, but it was something along the lines of who spent all the money or who used up what was supposed to last at least another 2 days or who drank all the liquor. To be clear, boyfriend is a generous description. Yes, we had been in each other's lives for months, but it was our shared bad habits that united us. And sex, of course. I didn't really understand relationships. My mother and father cohabitated. They raised children together, but it was akin to two farmers raising cattle. Our births, our lives, even our deaths were simply dedications to Christ. We had no choice in this. It was predetermined. There was no affection, and any hint at lust was a sin. So this guy that threw me out of his car on an isolated road in the middle of the night, him fucking me, spending time with me, that was enough. I thought that was what it meant to be with someone. Contrary to what you might assume, I was rather sober, trouncing on the side of the road. That's why we were fighting. We were both in need of something to take the edge off and out of what that something might be. The thick, damp night air had descended over the darkness, and my strategically torn-up band tee, cut-off shorts, and combat boots only really gave the moisture a place to settle. It was pitch black, cornfields hugging each end of the road. It was dark, so dark, that even when my eyes adjusted to it, all I could make out was the tall stalks, standing like an army waiting for an order of attack, and the dim moon above it, like its general. "Fuck," I whispered as I stumbled in the uneven dirt at the shoulder of the road. I rummaged my purse for my phone, but it was a shitty flip phone with no reception and barely gave out enough light to be of any help. As I exhausted my limited options, fear began to set in. The road was a type of quiet one rarely experiences unless they live in solitude. I could hear my heart rate pulsing in my skull and the ragged cadence of my feet dragging on the soil. He would be back, right? He wouldn't leave me like this with no money and nowhere to go, miles away from civilization. People aren't really that callous, are they? As 10 minutes passed, then 20, I realized some people can do that. They can just walk away or drive away, rather. They can erase you and your problems as if you never even existed. All I could do was pick a direction and walk. Hope harm wouldn't come my way in the meantime. As I marched ahead, an occasional rock I kicked skidded onto the road. The sound reminded me of marbles. They were one of the few toys we were allowed to play with as a child, lest the devil have his influence on us. In that quiet, every leaf rustling, every stalk waving in the wind, sounded like it could be something more. An animal? A person lying in wait? My mind blended shadows together to create all kinds of lurking figures. For those first 30 minutes or so, not a single car had driven by. I hadn't even seen a house, just industrial equipment parked in the fields, looking as though they were having a good night's sleep after a long day's work. I wasn't sure I even wanted to see a car. I might change my mind after another hour of walking, but what if I fell into the wrong hands? No one would ever even have a clue of what happened to me. I didn't trust in my so-called boyfriend to even report me missing, since the last thing he'd ever want to be was in contact with the cops. Hell, would he even check for me? I stopped suddenly and looked at the road ahead of me. There was no sign of civilization ahead, but I did see a sign. I ran towards a big green thing so that I could get close enough to read it. Next rest area, 13 miles.
Fuck!
I screamed into the black sky. I mean, one of those movie ones. The only thing I didn't do was drop down to my knees and fling my arms up in the air. It was a roar of despair. I was cold and hungry and too far away from my last dose of anything, and now I had a half marathon ahead of me if help didn't come my way. As part of my tantrum, I beat my purse at the ground in frustration. The dry dust kicked up and I could taste it. It coated my lungs, triggering a coughing fit. The clasp opened and out flew tissues and lip gloss, my empty wallet, and a gaggle of other random effects.
Fuck!
I shouted, louder this time at my own stupidity. A passing breeze lifted the sweat that had built from the walk off my skin, making the tiny hairs stand along my body like the crops in the field, bringing me back to the immediate predicament at hand. I needed to find someplace safe. There had to be a house somewhere, a farm, a factory. It was just so hard to see past the corn, and even if I saw something, it was a gamble deviating from the main road. If I walked into the fields on a hunch and was wrong, I could end up losing precious time and energy. I pressed my hands against my face, covered my eyes, and squatted down in temporary defeat. I can't believe this asshole left me here, I grumbled. Even with my eyes covered, I saw it, the bright beam of light that flooded the void. A vehicle, I thought, but when the heat touched my skin, instinctively, I knew it was something else. I opened my eyes and they burned. Was I dying? Is this the light? The next thing I can tell you with any clarity was that I was walking again, but things were different. It was as if I had just animated into this moment, seeing one foot raggedly place itself in front of the other, my balance like that of an amateur trying a tightrope, except there was firm ground beneath me. We've established that I am no stranger to drugs, but this, whatever it was, practically knocked me on my ass. As my focus slowly climbed to the surface, I turned a staggered, messy 180 degrees to get my bearings. I could only understand I hadn't moved far from my original spot because my purse and its spilled contents were on the ground a few yards behind me. I ended up on the ground again, though in my fugue state, I didn't recall falling, and I used this as an opportunity to sloppily corral my things together, using my forearm to scoop the contents along with dirt and rocks into my purse. My fingers didn't yet have their full dexterity. My violently shaking hands patted the ground in search of my phone, which I hoped had somehow miraculously gained a signal. Adrenaline was the only thing keeping me from succumbing to whatever was in my system and collapsing face first into the side of the road. This time, I heard something coming before I saw it. My heart vibrated with primal fear. I was scared of something specific, though I couldn't identify what. Maybe it was the fear that prompted the first images to surface. They were just shapes, as if viewing the memory through frosted glass, but what they made me feel was clear, unblemished terror. On the road, in the distance, I could see what I was hearing, a car or truck, its headlights growing from a pinpoint as it came over a slope on the road. I couldn't remember what had just happened to me, and for all I knew, whoever was coming towards me on this empty road had something to do with it. Though it might have taken minutes to reach me, it wasn't enough time to make such an important decision through the mind-numbing haze I was experiencing. All I could muster was to remain frozen on the ground as the old pickup truck crossed me. I opened my mouth and a whimper escaped from my throat, but nothing that could possibly be heard over the sounds of an engine. I watched as it passed me with a dazed mixture of relief and angst. I still wasn't sure I wanted the passenger or passengers from that vehicle to notice me. And yet, I felt a loss. My savior might have been in that car. I dropped my head down and sobbed. A sudden scream of brakes halted behind me. I perked my head up, afraid to turn around. The smell of burnt rubber met my nose. Panic of the unknown set in, and I quickly reached for whatever was left of my purse contents on the road, probably collecting more dirt into it than anything of value. The engine some ways behind me held a steady, bubbling rumble. A door creaked and then slammed. Footfalls began. First, the clear smack of boots on asphalt, and then the crunch of dirt and rocks. They were hesitant at first, and then as they closed in on me, they sped up with certainty. Hey, are you okay? His voice was warm, so warm on this cold, foggy night, and it instantly took away the hysteria throbbing throughout my body. But maybe that was just my desperation talking, like how sometimes a wild animal will let a person come close because they understand this dangerous predator is somehow here to help. I slowly turned my head to look at him. Inexplicably, I expected to see a monster. Strange, as I never was one, even as a child, to fear the boogeyman. Because of the darkness and the lights on his car still shining, I couldn't make out many details, but I knew he was no monster. He was a tall shadow enveloped by a circle of light. I didn't answer. He put his hands up to show he meant no harm as he half crouched. "Are you okay?" I tried to say something, but my mouth was so dry, so devoid of any moisture and gritty with dirt, that only gravelly utterances emerged. "Okay," he answered. I could feel him thinking. Caring, I hoped. Though I knew almost nothing about him, I could feel my body melting, as if I could let go and he could scoop up the puddle that was me. He ran back to his truck and reached inside. I recoiled for a second until I saw what he pulled out, an old serape, one I could see had seen its fair share of campfires and naps in the back seat. He walked over carefully this time and draped it over my shoulders and crouched down beside me. "There's no reception out here, but I can take you to the police station or to the hospital." "No! No!" I shouted, falling on my ass and kicking away from him in a panic. It flashed in my mind's eye, a hospital. Bright lights, beeping, instruments. I had just been in a hospital, I think. And the police have never been my friends. "Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you. I'm just trying to help. We'll do whatever you want. But I can't leave you out here alone. You understand?" he asked. I nodded. "Can you tell me what happened?" he asked. I opened my mouth because I wanted to answer, but I couldn't. "It's okay. You don't have to tell me. You're safe now." I felt this ripple of warmth cascade along my body, like that first sigh of relief when you step into a hot shower on a cold day. We both waited in contemplative silence for a few beats until he spoke again. "Listen, I live a few miles from here. Why don't you come with me? I'll give you something to eat. You can shower. But if someone hurts you, maybe you shouldn't shower and we can go." I shook my head frantically, started to push away against the dirt and away from him before I could even understand what I was doing. "Whoa, it's okay." He reminded me of the cowboys in movies, how they speak to horses when they're trying to break them. "Like I said, whatever you want, but we need to get you somewhere safe. You shouldn't be out here alone, and at the very least, you could get hit by a car out here. I barely saw you." I nodded again, took a deep breath, and started to come to my feet, forgetting how intoxicated I was, and stumbled. "It's okay," he said in a voice so serene it was a whisper. "I got you." He helped me to my feet and fixed the blanket on my shoulders. That feeling of a hot bath came again. So much of the tension and anxiety that had locked my body into rigidity slid off of it like mud in a warm rain. He offered his arm and I held it gingerly as he guided me to the passenger seat of his car. A bell chimed, alerting to the open driver's side door as he walked around to it. It triggered another flash. Something about it agitated me, awoke a physical memory I could not conceptualize. The dome light shone down on me, and I looked down at my legs. Dried blood was caked on my inner thighs. I gasped under my breath and wrapped the blanket tighter. He slid into his seat, and for the first time I could see him in the full glow of the dome light. He was beautiful. Jet black, thick hair, and a smile that was more like a hug. But what got my attention, so much so that I became embarrassed with how long I had caught myself staring into them, were his eyes. Hazel or amber, you could call them, but they were almost yellow, like a purified honey drizzling in the sun. "I'm John," he said. His eyes quickly scanned me up and down, and for the first time I was self-conscious. I knew what he thought happened. I felt humiliated by the idea. He handed me a canteen, like something you'd get at an Army-Navy store. "I'm sorry, it's all I have." I didn't even ask what it was and yanked it out of his hands. I guzzled down what I anticipated would be cheap whiskey, but instead it was Kool-Aid. Cherry-flavored, to be exact. Memories of summer picnics battled with the flashes of the new vague, horrifying ones that wouldn't come up clear enough for me to make any sense of them. On any other night, I'd have had a little chuckle to myself at this country boy and his canteen of cherry Kool-Aid, but I drank every last drop with no outward emotion. "I'm Ruthie," I replied between breaths. He nodded. "All right, Ruthie. Let's get you clean and warm and fed. You're safe now. You understand?" I hadn't felt safe since I was 16. And I had never felt safer than I had in that moment in the car with this stranger named John. There was a single steaming bowl waiting for me on a dining table when I came out of the shower. I eyed it as I toweled off my damp hair, my body tented in a massive maroon t-shirt that smelled like Gain detergent and read Hillcrest High football. John offered me sweatpants, but I was so thin that not a single pair stayed on. "It's homemade," he said, almost shy about it. "Baked potato soup. I made it today for dinner and had extra. I put your clothes in the wash. Hope you don't mind." I couldn't remember the last time I had anything that didn't come from a gas station or cheap roadside diner. I nodded. "It smells amazing. Thank you." His eyes darted down to my legs and back up quickly. I looked down. "I'm sorry," he said. I saw what he was looking at, my skinned knees, the bruises on my legs. Some were from that night, some from before. "No, it's fine. I'm sorry," I replied, embarrassed about my state. "Don't apologize," he said, firm but kind. I resisted the urge to do so again and pulled out the dining room chair that filled the silence with a long, drawn-out yawn. "Coffee?" he asked, as he walked over towards a brewing pot. "Maybe some Kool-Aid?" I asked with a tone for the first time that night that was something other than despair. He cracked a smile. "So did I." He cocked his head towards me. "I could arrange that." I resisted the urge to inhale the soup as he pulled out a large pitcher and carefully crafted the red drink, which even included a few fresh slices of citrus. He placed it on the table beside a cup of black coffee, like he could anticipate I'd need both. From what I could gather, he lived alone in an old but well-maintained and appointed house. Much of it looked dated, but in a warm and inviting way, like the blanket he had pulled out of his truck. I take it you're not from here. I've never seen you before, and I know everyone." "No, I was just passing through," I said, beginning to feel myself clam up. I didn't want to talk about what happened to me that night, and I was afraid that's where he was leading.
"Where are you heading?"
I hadn't thought that far ahead. My ex, who abandoned me on the side of the road, was my home for the foreseeable future. I ended up at whatever motel he did. He had a cousin a few towns over, which is how we ended up in these parts. He had made promises to clean himself up, work a job that his cousin had hooked up. Needless to say, we had worn out our welcome and we would have probably ended up wherever the wind blew next. I'm not sure. My friend kicked me out of his car. I didn't have plans to stop here and I looked down at my shirt. Hillcrest? He grinned. Yep, most thrilling place on earth. Oh, if he only knew. Have you always lived here? I asked, genuinely interested, but also trying to steer the conversation away from me. Born and raised. I glanced over at a photo hanging on the wall. On it was a younger John with a man and a woman who looked old to be his parents. Your grandparents? I asked. Mom and Dad. They had me later in life. Thought they couldn't, and then he gestured to himself as if pleased he broke the curse. I chuckled a little bit. You kind of remind me of Superman, I said, coyly twirling my soup spoon. Oh? He raised his brow. Yeah, handsome farm boy with two older parents swooped in and rescued me. He snickered. Thank you? Oh, it's a compliment, I assured him. The lull in the conversation gave John the opportunity to say the difficult thing I knew he was mustering. Listen, Ruthie, I won't ask you this again, but if you want or need to talk about whatever happened to you tonight, I'll listen. No judgment. I won't go to the police unless you want me to. But if you change your mind at any moment, we can go. I just had to get that out there. Just so you knew. I would never tell him, but I appreciated the offer. Is there any more soup? I asked. He smiled. And Kool-Aid. I sat on that dining room chair, the very one where, a bit over a year ago, John nursed me back to health with baked potato soup and Kool-Aid and waited for him to return home. John, or as I like to call him, farm boy, made a nice living as an agricultural consultant. He would travel all over the state to look at farms that were having issues to test soil, suggest treatments for infestations, etc. He was the best. People said he had an uncanny ability to suss out an issue and was paid handsomely for that. He had a job 2 hours away and would be home any moment now. My butt could barely stay in the chair, my entire body electric with excitement. I heard his car pulling up the gravel road to our house. Lucky our dog ran up to the car and barked with excitement. Hey, Lucky, my good girl, I heard faintly through closed windows. The front door opened and he dropped his equipment on the floor beneath where we hung our coats. I sat silently waiting for him to notice me. Ruthie! He spun around and froze when I caught his eye. He looked worried to see me sitting there waiting for him so intently. Hey, baby. The concern was evident in his voice. Hey, farm boy, I replied flirtatiously. You're being abnormally still. Everything okay? He asked. I bit my lips together and looked down at my hands. They were holding a secret. Maybe it was a cruel joke, knowing that there was another secret between us, between me and the world. The one he promised to never ask about again, and I never offered to share despite how quickly we had grown so close. I think so, I said, revealing the contents in my hands, a plastic white stick. On it, two bright blue dashes. John was a brilliant man, a quick study, but I had never seen him so slow to put two and two together.
You mean, are you saying? No.
No way. I smiled and stood up. Oh, yes way. Very yes way. His mouth dropped open.
We're having a baby? You and me. A baby?
I nodded sheepishly, holding in the biggest smile I could ever produce. Despite how excited he was, I always had this small nugget of doubt that sat in the pit of my stomach, that John was too good for me, that he just wanted to save a bad girl, and that he'd get tired one day when he found someone like him who had never been bad a day in her life. He charged at me and scooped me up in his arms, twirling me in a circle. "We're gonna have a baby? I'm gonna be a dad? You're gonna be a mama? Are you happy?" I asked. "Happy?" He beamed and then kissed me fast and hard. "I'm the happiest fucking guy in the world, Ruthie. I love you so much." My life had changed so much since the night John found me on the side of the road. I wish I could tell you every detail of every day we had spent together since then, but no one has that kind of time. I can tell you this. He asked me where I was headed, and it was in the most literal and figurative sense of the word, nowhere. That was the worst place to be, I thought, but it turned out to be the best, because it meant I could start fresh right then and there. I could shed the person I was, the angry girl who felt unloved and unwanted, and I could grow into the person John already saw in me. John saw me on the side of the road and didn't see a junkie he could just drive by and forget. He saw a person of value, and because of that, I saw it for the first time, too. After I recovered at his place for a few days, John asked me if I wanted to stay in town. He could help me get some work, save some money for a room, build roots. It was a small community, and he was known and beloved by all. I took him up on the offer, except I never left. We fell in love so quickly after that, it never made sense to. We were pretty much inseparable, and almost miraculously, I didn't even feel the need for drugs or alcohol. In fact, I hadn't had a drop since the night he found me. I gained a few pounds, and the light returned to my eyes, and for the first time, I was happy. "I gotta go in for a shift at the diner," I moped, pulling away from John's embrace. "Brianna has the flu, so they're understaffed." "Aw, come on," he groaned, pulling me in and nuzzling into my neck. His hugs were a thing of magic. Many times I woke up from nightmares, flashes of the time I lost that night we met, and he would hug me, and my thoughts would awash in viscous warmth like milk and honey for the soul. And all the fear and images, the burning light in my eyes, the beeping, the shadowy limbs hovering over me, the clamps holding my arms and legs apart, the screams I realized after many nights were my own. They would all dissolve and I could go back to sleep. But John kept his promise to me. He never asked. I never told. I rolled my eyes with pleasure. "Oh, don't do this. I'll end up staying home, and that's not nice." I didn't need to work with the money John made. He had inherited the house, so expenses were low, but the diner took me when I had nothing, so I always helped whenever they needed me and also worked part-time at the library. I was hoping to go back to school soon to become a teacher. "I hate that you're such a good person," he chided. It warmed my heart and stung. I didn't feel I deserved to be called a good person. At least, not yet. I did all these deeds hoping one day they would tip the scale of the universe, that one day they would outweigh all the bad I did. I kissed John longingly, drank in one long look at his eyes, two amber halos, and he mouthed, "I love you." My mouth dipped back. John Jr. was the spitting image of his father the second he came out of my womb. "Look at those eyes," the nurses marveled. I loved that boy with all my heart. Not more than his father, just different. My heart was so full sometimes it hurt. When I was on the street, I had no fear. I had nothing to lose. My life was frantically in the present. Where would I sleep, eat, get my supply? But now, I had too much. So the love I felt in my chest ached with a gnawing feeling. It was the most precious resource on earth, and it was irreplaceable. John Jr., we called him Johnny or Junior or Johnny Jr., was such a quiet baby, almost to the point where it was concerning. The doctors assured me over and over again he was fine. That babies, just like adults, have temperaments, and I should be thrilled to have such a placid child. He was a joy. As Johnny Jr. grew older, he seemed to powerfully gravitate towards his father. When he took his first steps, I put my arms out for him, and instead of walking in a straight line towards me, he turned and waddled towards his father. When I tried to tuck him in at night, he'd ask for daddy. It stung a little bit, since the trend is usually that little boys gravitate to their mamas. Sometimes I wondered if Junior knew that deep inside his father was the better of the two of us. John told me not to worry. He's just a little boy, and boys want to be like their daddy. That Junior loved me dearly, and this was just a phase like any other. As usual, John's words were like a salve. Then, one night, I noticed something strange. I was at the dinner table at night studying very late. I fell asleep on my books, and when I woke up, the clock read 1:15 a.m. I sat up, willing myself to walk to bed, when I heard the faint laughter of a child echo down the hallway. It was Johnny Jr., and as I perked my ears up, I could hear he was talking to someone. Maternal worry kicked in. John was out of town on an overnight work trip. It was just me and Johnny in the house. As I crept up to his door, little giggles carried down the hall. Was someone in his room? I pressed my ear against the door. "Another joke, Daddy," he begged. I sighed in relief. John had rushed home to surprise us, and he was tucking him back into bed. I opened the door with a smile, but it rushed off my face. Johnny was lying in bed, alone. I glanced around the room to see if John or anyone was sitting around, but he wasn't. I ran to his closet and pulled it open. Nothing but his clothes were inside. "Johnny, who are you talking to?" I asked. He frowned, and I felt like I had frightened him. I sat beside him. "Hey, baby, it's okay. You can tell Mommy. You aren't in trouble. Were you talking to Daddy? Do you miss him because he's at work?" He sat up and looked down, biting his lip. I brushed his floppy jet black hair. Keeping his chin down, he looked up at me with those glowing eyes and shook his head no. I sighed. "It's okay if you were. Sometimes it makes you feel better when you miss someone to talk to them." Johnny didn't look up, and I wondered if I should just leave it alone. I knew he was close to his father, and I loved it, but something gnawed at me. Was I jealous of my own husband? Was that driving this? Kids say and do weird things all the time. As I sat there patiently waiting for a response, I could sense Johnny was hiding something. Maybe it was mother's intuition. I didn't want to push harder, so I waited, hoping the leeway would give him room to trust me the way he trusted his father. He looked up again, measuring my facial expression. I kissed him on the forehead. It was salty and moist. A few strands of hair stuck to his forehead. He was sweating. "It's okay, sweetie," I assured him. The blanket squirmed above his lap as his little fingers fidgeted underneath. I felt like he might enlighten me at any moment, so I waited. Silently. Patiently. "What's going on?" Johnny's voice called from the doorway, just as I swore Junior was about to answer. I startled and looked around. "What are you doing home?" John continued, "I missed you both and just drove straight home instead of staying overnight. Figured I'd just slip into bed with you, but you weren't in bed. Little man is up at this hour? Is everyone staying up past their bedtime?" His black hair was a mess on his head, his eyes radiated, reflecting the bedside lamp that emitted a light the same color as his eyes. I couldn't label it, but the normally sweet gesture felt, well, I felt like I was caught doing something, like I was being monitored. But that's how it is when you don't have the tools. You can read the same language and interpret things differently. My son loving his father so deeply meant something was wrong with me. And my husband surprising me at almost 2 a.m. because he missed me was him keeping tabs. I shook off the toxic thoughts. I fell asleep studying and I heard Johnny talking, so I was just making sure he went back to sleep. I noticed Johnny was looking up at his dad, practically levitating, a far cry from the chagrin on his face when it was just the two of us. They locked eyes, and I swear it sometimes felt John didn't even have to say a word to get Johnny to comply. "You okay, buddy?" "Yes, Papa." "All right. Well, Mommy and I are turning off the light. You go to bed, okay? No more fussing, okay?" Johnny nodded and almost enthusiastically tucked himself under the covers. All the trepidation I sensed from him had evaporated into nothing. I kissed him on the forehead. He looked so much like his father. Sometimes it felt like there was nothing of me inside of him. John grabbed my hand and led me back to bed. "You okay?" he asked. "I'm fine," I mumbled. "Ruthie?" He strung out the last syllable in mock disappointment. I could never lie to him, and he knew it. I sighed and shook my head. "It's silly, but he was talking to you when he was in there?" "Me?" he asked incredulously. "Like I said, it was dumb, but he was giggling and laughing like you were in there, so when I walked in and you weren't, first I was scared someone else was in the room, and then when I had asked what he was up to, he clammed up the way he always does with me." "How do you even know he thinks he was talking to me?" John asked. "Well, he specifically said daddy," I answered, a little short. John let out a heavy sigh. He knew how I felt about the fact that our son favored him. "You know kids, they have wild imaginations. I'll talk to him tomorrow about it, but that's normal. Kids have such vivid imaginations, and they don't think in terms of reality. He's a sweet kid, and he loves us, and he'll grow out of these imaginary friends." "How many kids' imaginary friends are their own dad?" I chided. He chuckled and hugged me from behind. "I guess I must be pretty awesome." I pushed against him playfully and he pulled me back into his arms. That sense of complete ease John provided came over me and I felt completely secure. I wish it ended there, that there weren't any other odd moments, things that alone seemed perfectly within the spectrum of normal human behavior. There were times at dinner where Johnny and his father would play staring games. Johnny would belly laugh until he was in tears. It was like a game I wasn't allowed to play. Sometimes it felt like there was a joke, an actual joke. Everyone but me could hear. Once Johnny laughed so hard his drink squirted out of his nose. It made me laugh too. I said something along the lines of, "I can't imagine what is so funny, Johnny." "Daddy is tickling my brain," he said. Most of those incidents, if you could even call them that, were insignificant and only became more apparent in hindsight. They were small blips, if one could even call them that, a joyous life John and I had built. But there was one incident that even at the time struck me as wildly unusual, something that weighed on me and could never quite be explained. John was working hours away with a client. Johnny Jr. was almost 4, and it wasn't unusual for him to play behind the house, which was an open field, as our next neighbor was about a mile away. I could see him from the kitchen, and he was never the type to stray. I had stepped away from the window just for a minute to grab a load of laundry when I heard my cell phone. It was John. "Hey, farm boy," I answered. "Where's Johnny?" The panic in his voice instantly made me sick to my stomach. "He's here in the yard, playing like he always does." I realized I didn't have eyes on him and dropped the basket. "Why? What is it?" I asked as I ran back to the kitchen. I just have a feeling." "You're scaring me," I said as I glanced out through the window and saw he was nowhere in sight. "I don't see him, John. I don't see him. Where are you? What's going on?" "Go to the tree." John was always the calm one. He never raised his voice. "Now," he yelled. I ran over to the tree, an old sick oak that Johnny was not allowed to play on. As I neared it, I could see him lying still beneath it in the tall grass. "Oh my God, oh my God," I cried. I could hear John on the phone in my hand, but I was too frantic to put it up to my ear. On the ground beside our son was a broken branch. His right arm was bent out of shape. I lifted the phone and I thought I heard him say, I can't hear him. I can't hear him. I heard him repeating, almost as if he was mumbling it to himself. "He fell off a tree. His arm is broken," I sobbed. "He's not awake. Oh my God, what do I do?" "Check to see if he's breathing," John ordered. I did, and he was. I gently tapped his cheek and he stirred. "He's awake now," I practically screamed. Yeah, I know," John replied. "Call an ambulance. I'll meet you at the hospital as fast as I can." I was a guilt-ridden mess at the hospital. I was supposed to be watching our son, and I turned away for a minute, and I could have lost him. Johnny had a concussion, of course, and a broken arm. The doctor said he was young and the broken bone would heal quickly. They kept him for a few hours to monitor the concussion. John got to the hospital just as the doctor was talking to me about discharging him soon. John was eerily calm, a far cry from the panic he was in earlier. "He's going to be fine. I know it," he assured me. He hugged me and I felt it too. Our son would be fine. When we finally had some time alone, one night with Johnny tucked in bed and both of us with some wine in our hands, I finally brought up what I had wanted to ask my husband since the accident. "How did you know?" "You knew." "Knew what?" he asked. I gestured towards Johnny's bedroom. John shrugged it off. "I just had a premonition, a strong premonition, I guess. If it was one of those silly things at dinner, I wouldn't have pressed it, but this couldn't be explained away as a child's silly imagination or a special bond. I had stepped away for a minute, and in that minute, John knew our son was hurt from hundreds of miles away. So I pressed. "Okay, but then you said something. You said you couldn't hear him." I wouldn't even call what John did a chuckle. It was so faint a reaction, I would have missed it had I blinked. "I did." He paused to reflect. "I think it's because you wouldn't answer me and Tim was asking if he was okay and I was answering him. Maybe that's when I said that, because you had found him, but I expected to hear his voice, his cry, anything, and I couldn't. I was freaking out too, Ruthie. My family needed me and I was too far away to help." Of course, that made perfect sense. I almost felt embarrassed for the implication. "Baby, Are you suggesting I can read his mind or something? He asked with a half smirk. You know what? Never mind. I shook my head and looked away. This whole thing was just so stressful. John narrowed his eyes. You and him do that same thing. What? You make the same face when you're embarrassed. We do. I'd never thought Johnny and I looked anything alike. I sometimes joke that he was produced asexually by John. It felt good to hear he saw me and Johnny. John studied my face warmly. Oh yeah, he has some of your facial expressions and your laugh when he can't stop laughing. That's why I love to make him laugh. He pulled me in so that I leaned into his arms and I felt all my doubts dissolve. I couldn't have picked a better human on this earth to be the mother of my child, he whispered. I fell asleep in his arms on the sofa that night. Nightmares were a common occurrence for me, but they were brief flashes and I couldn't remember most of them by the time I had woken up. The feeling I awoke with was usually the worst part, a pure terror that echoed from whatever happened that night in the cornfields. Something about having John there for me made me forget. But around the time Johnny turned 6, I found out I was pregnant again. I had just gotten my teaching degree and found a job as a first grade teacher at the local elementary school. Things were looking great, and we were thrilled to be welcoming a little girl into our family. That's why I was so distressed about the nightmares getting stronger. They were frequent and becoming more vivid. Johnny could always help me fall back asleep, but he couldn't stop the dreams from happening. I felt sicker with this pregnancy, too, as if my body was rebelling. I would wake up at night with violent stomach pains, but no doctor could find anything wrong with me or the baby. Unlike my first pregnancy, where my hair grew thick and my skin was dewy, chunks of hair fell out in the shower and dark circles formed around my eyes. No matter how much I ate, I got thinner. Yet my stomach grew and all the sonograms indicated the baby was a healthy weight. I, on the other hand, was wasting away. If not for the weight of the life growing inside me, I would probably have weighed the same as when John found me on the road. John was perfect through all of this. I was too under the weather to get out of bed most days and depressed by the stressful pregnancy, and he picked up the slack with Johnny. And while somewhere inside of me I wondered if that would only make him even closer to his father and in turn less so with me, I was too tired to care. I often wondered why John still didn't ask about the nightmares. Surely there was a burning curiosity inside of him. That's not to imply I wanted him to ask. In fact, one of the deepest fears I had was that one day John would demand to know why his wife thrashed in her dreams and was still afraid of hospitals. So much so that I had Junior at home and insisted the same for the upcoming child, despite signs that this pregnancy was not like the first. At the same time, I wanted John to want to know. But he was a man of his word. He told me years ago that he would always be there to listen, but he wouldn't ask. And I feared that if I told him what I remembered and what I thought happened to me, the beautiful life we had built would crumble when he saw the drug addict he took in was also insane. Late into my pregnancy, I had the dream. It was so vivid I could smell the dirt road in my own body odor from the countless days of binging on drugs. I saw the light that blinded me. I felt its heat radiating on my skin. But instead of blacking out, instead of it dissolving into blurry shapes and muffled sounds, I saw what happened next. Some one thing grabbed me. I screamed and tried to fight, but as soon as it touched me, a feeling washed over me. I completely surrendered, following its lead. I couldn't see, but I felt the grip around my arm wasn't human. I walked with it deep into the field and into a vessel of sorts. Everything went pitch black. The hand let go and I was alone again. I screamed for help and asked what I was doing in this place, but there was no response. Out of nowhere, multiple hands gripped my arms, ankles, wrists. I tried to wriggle free, but they lifted me and placed me against a flat surface, buckling me down so my legs were spread open the way they would be at a gynecologist's visit. They pressed something against my forehead. My body went limp and I could feel hot piss flowing out of me. My thoughts went dim, but the terror coursing through my veins and maybe even my tolerance to drugs wouldn't allow me to give in completely. While cloudy, I could see them doing things between my legs. Long instruments were shoved inside of me. The lamp shining in my eyes made it tough to make out any details. All I knew was they were violating me, putting things inside of me, maybe taking things out, and I was powerless to stop them. I wanted to howl, I wanted to cry and shriek, but my body was useless. It felt like it would never end. I felt like I would die. No one would know or care what happened to me. And then it stopped. The room was dark again, the table I was on tilted upright, the clasps released, and I sank towards the ground just as hands caught me. I drifted in and out of consciousness, though I could still walk. The beings bore most of my weight as I staggered back to the spot where they found me, where I eventually would start to regain my memory, where Johnny would drive by some minutes later and save my life. They left so quietly, I didn't know they were gone at first. Then there I was, stumbling around for minutes as the fog slowly began to lift. Then I found my purse and I heard a car coming in the distance. I shot up out of bed, screaming louder than I ever had before, my body soaked in sweat, flailing. This was the worst it had ever been, and this was the first time I had a repeatable narrative for what had happened to me. I'd always had a feeling, an inkling, but my memories were shadows, and this nightmare, this memory, was an elaborate portrait. The terror I felt as I woke was so strong that I forgot where I was now, in my bed, at home. "Ruthie! Ruthie!" I heard John yell, but his voice felt so far away. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't get air as the panic choked me. His eyes honed in at the doorway, and I saw my son standing there, watching his mom devolve into horror, and I knew I had to get this dream's hold off of me. John grabbed my arms and bear hugged me, and just like that, I was grounded. My breathing began to slow. The details of the room began to come into focus. The hot honey of his embrace drizzled over me. "I'm sorry," I muttered as I relaxed every muscle and caved into his arms. "It's okay," he whispered as he rocked me in his arms and kissed my temple. "I'm going to put Johnny back to bed." John returned faster than I had expected. He leaned against the bedroom doorframe and blew air up out of his mouth so that his hair flopped against his forehead. "He's fine," John said before I could ask. I decided I wouldn't wait for John to ask me about that night. How could I share a life with this man and hide the very thing that brought us together? I remembered what happened to me. John stared at me for a few seconds, his expression, a void. The night you found me. It wasn't that I didn't want to tell you, I didn't really understand, and what I felt it could be, it was crazy. Just as I was about to reveal the contents of my nightmares, a wild pain tore through my stomach, like a scorched sword slicing through my pregnant belly.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
I hollered in pain and gripped my bump. John ran towards me just as I felt the bed soak beneath me. My water! Before I could finish another sharp pain, I cried out in agony. John, something's wrong. These weren't contractions, at least not like I had with Johnny. These felt like hot metal tearing into my abdomen. Okay, I'm calling Dr. Grayson, John said. Hurry, I cried. There was a brief reprieve from the pain, but before he could grab his cell phone, an even more horrendous surge of pain sprung from inside me, and this time I could feel her, the little baby girl inside of me, clawing her way out. She's coming, I screamed. What, now? He asked. I nodded through a moan of agony. I didn't even have to push. Everything about this pregnancy was different, including how it felt like she might rip me to shreds on her way out. The pain was so all-consuming. My consciousness slipped in and out of focus. On all fours on our bed, I contorted my body into odd shapes, looking for even a second of relief as the newborn ripped her way out of me. My muscles cramped and my spine arched as I gripped the sweat-soaked sheets. John tried to grab his phone, but I screamed for his full attention. No doctor could help us. She was imminent. With cold sweat dripping from my brow, I let out one long animal wail, feeling her final push for an escape. Every muscle in my body trembled as it felt like she was destroying everything she touched on her way out. But just as fast as the pain had come, it was gone. John had caught her. I sank forward onto the damp, messy bed. It had felt more like an exorcism than a childbirth. But following the violence, there was quiet, a momentary relief from the pain followed by a sinking feeling. Seconds long, but nearly eternal. The baby. My words barely made it out through breathlessness. John didn't say anything as he came from behind holding the bloody lump. Our eyes locked and I saw a fear in him I had never seen before. I wanted to die at that moment. I just knew she was a stillbirth. Then I heard a faint cry, the tiniest little beautiful cry. She's okay, baby. She's okay. John's voice wavered between joy, fear, and relief. I rolled onto my back and surrendered every muscle in my body through racking sobs of joy. I couldn't even lift my head. I tilted my eyes toward John to get a glimpse of our little girl wrapped in his arms in a towel. Her cry grew into a shrill scream. She was a force. She would one day grow up to be a strong woman. We would clash. She would drive me crazy. I knew it. I was in love. Just relax, baby. I'm calling an ambulance. I know you don't want to go, but we should get you looked at. I wanted to fight John to convey the sheer panic those words brought to me, but I could hardly move. I could only imagine what was going through John's head, the unwashed newborn baby in his arms, an unwell wife on the bed, a young son to attend to had snuck to watch from outside the bedroom door as this all took place. It wasn't until the EMS pulled me onto a stretcher that I saw all the blood. Our ordinarily white bedsheets looked like a slick black in the shadows of the night. There was more than that, though, a mess that reflected how I felt on the inside, like shredded guts. The exhaustion kept me from fighting, but overnight, the nightmares triggered by the stark lights and the feeling of being observed clinically came to me in my sleep to the point they had to sedate me. Yet somehow, when all was said and done, the doctor said I was just fine. We counted our blessings, how lucky we were for both mother and child to be so healthy through what seemed like such a turbulent pregnancy and birth. The strange pregnancy, the unbearable pain, the sudden and aggressive birth, the feeling of being torn from the inside, that wasn't normal, and yet it had all turned out fine. In the weeks following little Victoria's birth, I felt like a plant that hadn't been watered or given sun that had finally found a place on the windowsill. My hair started to bounce back to its original luster, my skin flushed, my energy climbed a bit more each day, my breasts were flush with milk, and Victoria fed vigorously. It was so unlike what I should have been experiencing as a new mother after such a traumatic birth, but I was grateful to be myself again. Little Vicky also looked just like her father, with those almost feline yellow eyes and dark hair. John had those powerful genes, and he doted on his little girl. I didn't care anymore if Johnny or even Vicky preferred their dad. After such a close call, I was just so grateful to be alive and have my beautiful family. Vicky was about 8 months old the night they came. After the miraculous birth, life had settled. My anxieties waned. The petty jealousy that crept up about how much Johnny preferred his father had dissipated as I bonded with my little girl. These were the months of the mother. She needed me, my body, my milk, and we bonded skin to skin as she suckled from my breast. Even Johnny was all mine during those early months when he couldn't walk away. We had settled into the familial rhythms of a new addition. John worked and helped take care of the household when I couldn't carry all of the load. It was a sweet time, an innocent time, a time I will look back on fondly. After years of nightly torment, my nightmares had settled. They had once again lost their sharpness. I no longer woke up from them. Instead, I would wake up remembering I had felt fear, but the images didn't chase me into the world of awakeness. It was a Friday night, and we put the kids to bed, so it was just John and me. I relished this time with him. I'd pour myself a glass of wine, and he'd have a beer, and we'd settle together on the sofa. One of us would pick what we were watching, and the rule was we had to respect whoever's turn it was. That night, it was my turn, and I was feeling indecisive. I don't know, I groaned as I browsed through the various recordings with my clicker. I'm just going to browse what's on TV. John stood up and kissed me on top of my head. Okay, I'll be right back. Just keep looking. I didn't pay him much attention as I flipped through the channels. Then something caught my eye. It was the local news. On it was grainy live footage and a graphic that read, "Breaking news." Something seemed to be unfolding, so I stayed on the screen. The chyron read, "Mysterious vessels spotted hovering throughout multiple countries." My cell phone pinged with the text, but I didn't look right away. There was a map on the screen. Little blips appeared to highlight the various spottings throughout the world. There were several scattered throughout the U.S. The phone pinged again with the unanswered text. I reached for my cell, trying to keep my eyes on the screen. It was my friend, Brianna. "Hey, are you watching the news? Something is happening." The map cut away to an anchor, waiting for his signal to speak, holding a hand against his ear, squinting. He was somewhere dark and barren, a field, it looked like. Coming from his left side was a powerful glow, though the source hadn't yet been revealed. He seemed to receive the delayed news he was on air. He said he was reporting from somewhere. I can't recall. Maybe it was a small town in Iowa or Nebraska or Wisconsin. I can't remember. "John?" I called out as an old feeling began to climb out from wherever it had been hiding these past few months. The anchor said things were developing rapidly, but there had been sightings all over the world. He gestured towards a light while shielding his eyes, and the camera panned over, but whatever it was so bright, the camera couldn't seem to convey it. He tried to explain his view, but it was as if he couldn't believe his own words. Words and phrases like "hover," "descended from the sky," "no known affiliation to any country," "completely silent," and then "UFO." He pressed against his ear and said they were cutting to cell phone footage from Nice, France. When he did, I jumped from my seat and tipped over my wine glass. It was daylight there and the view was clearer. "John!" I called again. Worry filling my voice as I tried to contain the wine spill, I felt something like a punch to my chest as I thought back to the nightmare I had the night I gave birth to Vicky. I recognized the thing floating just above the open field, the night I met the love of my life. I regretted never telling John about what happened that night. After Vicky was born, so much was going on with the addition to our family, and my health was looking up, and the nightmares had lessened. I felt bringing up the past might spoil things, but now I knew it was real. Now I would have to confess. I called out for John again as loudly as I could without waking the kids. He didn't answer. Frustrated, I went in search of him. He wasn't in our bedroom or the bathroom. Then I glanced over at little Johnny's room and saw light spilling from underneath the door. I opened it and saw John holding Vicky, bundled in his arms. Johnny was packing his own little bag. "What's going on? What are you doing?" I asked my husband. He must have seen the news. He must be panicking. "Are we being invaded?" I thought. "This can't be real." He looked at me with those same eyes that had stared lovingly at me for years, those eyes that exuded the warmth of a late spring sunset as I woke up screaming from nightmare after nightmare, the eyes that widened with joy when I told him I was having our children. But now they were devoid of anything other than focus, predatory-like focus. Like there was a serious mission at hand. "We have to go," he said flatly. "Hold on," I said. "Go?
Where? Is this about what's on the news?
He didn't answer. Instead, he just stared. Johnny continued to pack his little duffel bag.
We're not going anywhere until you explain. Johnny, stop,
I demanded. Our son stopped. John broke his stare and his eyes darted at our son, and I swear I saw a flash like when a light reflects against the cat's eyes in the dark. Johnny didn't hesitate to begin packing again as if he understood some silent command.
What is going on? Where are we going?
I pleaded. Don't you think you should have maybe consulted me before waking up the kids like this? Scaring them? I asked, though I couldn't help but notice I was the only one who showed any signs of worry. There was an unsettling calmness that had taken over my family, even the little baby girl sleeping soundly in my husband's arms. I was angry at John for the first time in as long as I could remember. Sure, we bickered over silly things, but I felt deeply wronged in a way I couldn't quite yet understand. I felt his actions solidify the tiniest doubt I had carried all along that despite us doing everything together, despite the love and happiness that grew abundant in our home, that I was somehow an outsider.
I'm sorry, Ruthie, he said with all of the emotion of a barista who got an order wrong.
Sorry? What are you talking about? John, you're freaking me out.
Johnny Jr. zipped up his bag, stood beside his dad, held his free hand, and stared up at me.
Put Vicky down. We need an adults-only conversation.
We're going to leave now, John said.
I'm not going anywhere, I shouted.
I know, he said.
My heart sank. I wasn't angry anymore. I was back to being scared.
What is happening?
I begged. A cloudy feeling of what was happening emerged in my mind's eye, but it was too vague and unthinkable to be understood, to be fleshed out into coherent thought. I had to make it all stop. I had to explain to him what happened that night. He needed to know everything so we could slow down and I could understand.
Honey.
Baby. My voice sounded like shattered glass. I have to tell you something. Something is happening. I think you know, but you don't know everything. Something happened to me.
I know what happened to you that night, Ruthie. My entire body shuddered.
You know?
He gave me a knowing nod, but how could he?
You mean when I was...
His silent stare affirmed my question. He looked at little Johnny. My little boy walked up to me and grabbed my hand. A wave of calm came over me, much like it would when his dad embraced me, but not quite as potent. But I didn't want this calm. I didn't ask for it.
Do you understand?
John asked. I shook my head as tears streamed down my face. Johnny returned to his father's side.
Why do you think it was so easy for you to get clean, Ruthie?
His tone was wrapped in something I had never heard from him, a thin condescension, pity for a fool. My mind swirled with a chaotic storm of memories, connections, assumptions. I tried to view our years together with a new lens, but emotion clouded too much. And still I thought I understood. He made me clean with his touch, his ability to make the pain wash away. I thought it was our special connection. I thought it was love. But maybe it was something else.
You're one of them?
He nodded. His detachment was such a stark contrast from the man I knew. I looked at the three of them across from me, all so much alike. I used to kid about how I was just an incubator and they were all John, but looking at them, all shiny black hair and yellow eyes, I understood that I had felt like an outsider this whole time because I was. Then it hit me like a flash. Another memory, if you could even call it that. It was just a glimpse. One of them walking me through the field. The light had blinded most of my vision, but one turned. Just for a moment. Then I caught a glimpse of glowing amber. John was like the earth under my feet, constant, firm, grounding. But now it was as if the entire earth had split under my feet and I was falling endlessly. You can't be. They weren't human, I protested.
You think in simple terms. Human terms, Ruthie.
It was as if it wasn't worth explaining beyond those words, like trying to explain math to a dog. I suddenly felt dizzy.
No, I muttered. John, baby, I love you. Please, it's me. Look at me. Talk to me.
He had to be in there. This all has to have meant something to him. We had shared tears and laughter, and he had nursed me to health, made me the woman and mother I had become. We had shared the most intimate emotional and physical moments two human beings could share. But he wasn't human.
Why are you doing this? I asked it. At least tell me you owe me that.
Without a word, he walked forward, trying to go around me. I jumped in front of him and screamed.
No, you owe me an explanation. You're not taking my babies.
You were a filthy creature on the side of the road. Worthless. You contributed nothing. I gave you purpose. The callousness of his words were such a devastating shock that I was stunned into a type of momentary catatonia. I had believed all those things about myself, and he had made me believe I was more. He had allowed me to forgive myself and grow. But what I understand now is what he saw was a convenient vessel, an unattached, fertile young woman he could use to procreate, a body. I had no family or friends to compete with him, a simple-minded human who he could feed, monitor her environment, and keep happy, a human test tube. He began to walk forward again. I screamed for him, and he didn't even look back. I felt desperate. This man was kidnapping my babies. I did only what I could think of, and that was to run into our bedroom and grab the shotgun out of our closet. Sometimes I used to fantasize about if those things returned for me or my family, how I would blast them away with that gun. My hands felt like someone else's as I watched them shake uncontrollably while loading the shells. I ran back out to him, just about to make it to the doorway and cock the thing. He stopped and turned. There was the slightest hint of smugness as he held little Vicky against his chest. Poor, stupid human, he must have thought to himself. If they observed us like animals, if they chose us, vetted us as prime candidates for procreation, then he knew I would never risk harming my children, even if I hated him with every fiber of my being. But if they studied us, then they'd also know. I didn't hate him. Not yet. We Homo sapiens tend to still love those who hurt us. I let the gun slide down to my side. From the corner of my eye, I could see a flood of light come in through the living room window. It was here. Of course, I would die for my children. I would die if he took them. But also, being a pathetic human, I didn't want him to leave. I didn't want my John, the fabrication that still existed in my heart as a real person, to go. I didn't want him to die. I was willing to do anything to keep us together. Take me, please. I gave birth to them, right? You must have needed that for some reason. I can keep doing it. We can make more babies.
Please don't take my little girl. Please don't take my baby boy. I'll do anything you want. I'll leave this fucking planet. Please don't leave me here alone.
His eyes narrowed and head tilted as he studied my face. It reminded me of the way a little boy studies a bug before he decides if he will be the type to squash it or if he'll let it go.
I love you, John. You're the love of my life.
I supplicated before him. If I could move, I would have dropped to my knees. Thinking back now, rather than being moved by this, he was probably disgusted. Ruthie. His voice had the whisper of the softness reminiscent of the husband I adored. You can't come. You're of no use any longer.
Don't you love me? This can't all have been an act.
John was perfectly human, in the way his eyes emoted, his hugs, his laugh, his understanding of what it was to be one of us. And yet there had been things along the way, things that seemed inhuman, that I had brushed off. Vicky cooed in his arms. She was a human baby, wasn't she? Wasn't my little giggling Johnny a little human boy? I can't love you, Ruthie. Could you have loved Lucky as a partner? Lucky, our dog who was now in an urn above the fireplace. But I do appreciate your contribution. It's why I'm bothering to explain this to you at all. I hope it is a consolation to you that you will be the mother of our new race, one far superior to yours.
I don't understand.
You made her. You made the one. I couldn't weave the threads perfectly, but on a primal level, on a mother's level, on a woman's level, I understood now what the point was.
Vicky, my little girl, I wasn't the true broodmare. I would be left here with the chance to choose a new life. It was her they had been after all along. And now that she was old enough to live away from my bosom, they were taking her.
I roared a lion's roar and sprinted at him, reaching for her, but my little boy, my Johnny, grabbed me, and the powerful wave of force calm flooded me, and I collapsed to the floor. Barely able to move, I pleaded,
"Please, John, please don't take my life away. Don't do this to our baby."
It was as if I was a ghost and he could walk
right through me. He simply shook his head, perhaps disgust with himself that he had explained anything at all, that some foolish human virtue had, in fact, rubbed off on him. He began to walk towards the door. My body was limp, but the kindred mother fought. The pain of a mother whose baby has been stolen from her arms somehow drove me. I fought for the pain instead of letting it wash away, and it propelled me like an explosion. The agony fueled me enough so that I could drag myself to John's feet.
Please don't leave me, John. Please don't take my babies.
I grabbed at the cloth of his pants as he maintained an unbroken stride. I could feel his revulsion at the crying sack of meat pawing at the leg of his jeans. The merciful thing would have been to kill me and take me out of my misery before leaving. I wept on the floor as his footsteps stopped at the front door. He opened it and the light flooded our entryway. I wailed as he shut it behind him. Then darkness and silence, a hollow abyss. John just needed a body, DNA, whatever it was that they came to this planet for. John fed off of me, took the best of me, and he was finished. I was an inferior being to my own family, the infants I grew out of my womb, the babies I birthed, the husband I loved, the husband who made love to me. But it wasn't love, you fool. It was insemination. Ruthie, you were an incubator. And you were so easy to fool. All it took was a little love and attention. You are only human, after all.
If you enjoyed Twisted Mirror, I'd appreciate you taking a moment to rate and review the show. If you'd like episodes at least a week early and bonus peeks at the mirror, check out Twisted Mirror's Patreon at twistedmirrorpodcast.com.